You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Let me start off by saying that you don't often hear today's passage in church, partly because it's not in what's called the common lectionary, that set of readings shared by many churches for each Sunday. However, Mark and Luke's much shorter versions are in the lectionary. Why is Matthew's excluded? Because it's been deemed as too harsh and makes Jesus sound abrasive. The lectionary opts for a more gentle Jesus, and not Matthew's Jesus, who rolls out a big quote from Isaiah saying, you know, most people are idiots. That's in the Hebrew. As you'll hear, Isaiah is in the middle of losing his temper and is screaming at the Israelites that in response to their idolatry and injustice, Assyria is going to come and crush them. And the people around him go, interesting. Seems a little outlandish to me. Anyway, I'm off to keep adding to my riches until I consume all the resources of my impoverished neighbors. Pass the mustard, please. Jesus is essentially at the end of that same rope, saying, it clearly doesn't matter what I say to these people. They listen, but they don't hear. And I think Matthew hoped that his predominantly Jewish audience would have been familiar enough with Isaiah and what happened to their ancestors at the hands of the Assyrians to say, wait, what? And pay closer attention to Jesus. In all three synoptic gospels, this passage is right after one of Jesus' most famous parables, the parable of the sower. And clearly, not even the lunkheads are sure what Jesus is getting at. So they complain to him and ask, why don't you just tell us outright what you're getting at? What's with the parables, dude? And behold, our passage unfolds. Jesus offers a rationale for teaching in parables, a way of teaching that often leaves the hearer not with answers, but with more questions. And Jesus is a teacher whose style is intentionally oblique, evocative, and even teasing. Scholars agree that the historical Jesus never said, here, let me give you a quick 4-bullet-point summary of what I'm talking about. He intentionally throws his hearers into what Walter Brueggemann called a crisis of imagination. He makes you think and ask, oh, okay, well, what does this mean? And here's why. The very second parables start getting explained, they get tamed. They get toned down. They get less radical. And that's exactly what happens right after our passage in all three of the synoptic gospels. Very early on, scribes came in and said, let's help the folks out a bit here and have Jesus tell them exactly what he actually meant after all. No! Thank you for playing. But there it is. Right from the beginning, we have the earliest followers of Jesus doing exactly what Jesus said he didn't want to do. And so here they are putting words in his mouth, even right after he says, no, I'm not spelling it out. You have to work it out for yourself. Until you learn to see with your own eyes, hear with your own ears, use your imagination, and ask the tough questions, you just won't get it.
Our words of wisdom are from Matthew chapter 13, verses 10 through 17.
Then the disciples came and asked Jesus, why do you speak to them in parables?
He answered, to you it has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven. But to them it has not been given. For to those who have, more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But to those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away.
The reason I speak to them in parables is that seeing they do not perceive, and hearing they do not listen, nor do they understand. With them indeed is fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah that says,
"You will indeed listen, but never understand, and you will indeed look, but never perceive. For this people's hearts have grown dull, and their ears are hard of hearing, and they have shut their eyes, so that they may not look with their eyes and listen with their ears, and understand with their heart and turn, and I would heal them."
But blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. Truly I tell you, many prophets and righteous people longed to see what you see, but did not see it, and to hear what you hear, but did not hear it.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
You've heard the one about the person who asked their rabbi, "Why do rabbis always answer a question with another question?" And the rabbi asked, "So what's wrong with the question?" Jesus was typical of the rabbis of his day. And according to the Gospels, he rarely gave a straight answer to a question. Instead, he responded with another question or told a story, usually with characters or elements designed to shock or annoy religious people. At the risk of disappointing his questioners, Jesus put them in a position of having to think for themselves. Rather than offer his followers answers to life's most perplexing problems, Jesus introduced them to deeper and deeper levels of ambiguity. Matthew's collection of Jesus' sayings, the Sermon on the Mount, including the Beatitudes, is just one example of how Jesus confronted his disciples with contradictions. "Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are the hungry, for they will be filled." What? The parables, though, powerful, challenging stories without a clear single point or a moral to the story, were probably Jesus' favorite way of teaching. Why? Matthew has Jesus quoting Isaiah's frustration. People listen, but they don't understand. They look, but don't perceive. Their hearts have grown dull, their ears hard of hearing, and they've shut their eyes. In short, the prophets have told them straight to their faces, but they blow them off. Parables demand thought and are often hard to understand. So the whole point of parables is that they are engaging, they're disturbing, they're puzzling, they require work on the part of the hearer. In verse 10, Jesus tells the disciples that they've been given to know secrets. Now in Greek, the word used is mysteria, the root word of mystery in English. And in the first century, it didn't mean hopelessly dark and unintelligible, but simply impossible for the outsider to understand. And back in those days, Greek mystery religions were a dime a dozen. And part of their whole identity was keeping secrets from all but the initiated. So despite that not being Jesus' style, even the earliest Christians were conditioned by the surrounding mystery cult culture to expect mysteria to be explained. They wanted to tame the parables and give them single dogmatic answers. But Jesus was not on about simple answers. Why? because answers provide false confidence and security and become barriers to an awareness of the divine. In fact, answers can become substitutes for God. And it seems to me that the task of the church is not to provide answers, but to provide a context where those who want to be followers can find the courage to pursue their questions and seek personal experiences that inform their understanding. One of my friends and mentors, Tex Sample, tells a story about the time he decided to save some money and pour his own concrete patio. In an age before YouTube videos, he did what you'd expect of any theologian and scholar. He sat down and read everything he could find about concrete finishing. However, nothing he had read prepared him for the reality of standing in the middle of a 10-foot by 30-foot, 10-inch deep pool of liquid concrete, especially when he was standing in that 10 inches of concrete wearing 8-inch high waders. As he said of such experiences, to live it gives you a whole new perspective and opens up a whole new appreciation for the process and probably inspires a few more questions. The journey is what's important. What we learn along the way through difficulties, mistakes, and challenges. E.M. Forster, author of Room with a View, said, "Life is a public performance on the violin in which you must learn the instrument as you go along." There's a legend told by Native American parents to teach their children that the easy way is not the best way. There are two paths of life. One slopes gently down some low hills to the valley below. It's a broad and easy path, but leads to a desert where death waits. The other path winds upward over a steep and rocky trail. It's filled with many difficulties, and only the determined can reach the summit. In other words, it's a parable. Strong character is built by facing obstacles and overcoming them instead of seeking a life of ease by avoiding difficulties. The process is what's important. It's about the journey. You don't get there by simply reciting the Jesus prayer or claiming Jesus as your sweet and fluffy Lord and Savior, and then you're done. In a word, it's evolutionary rather than revolutionary. Now, for the Methodist goobs out there, yes, we have goober technical language for this whole process. The moment of realizing God's love for us is called justification, which is revolutionary. Then comes the work of sanctification, where we seek to become more holy, which is evolutionary. It takes work, questions, and searching to, in Wesleyan language, go on to perfection. The bottom line, asking questions is not just accepted, it's expected. To not ask questions is to forfeit your spiritual birthright and allow others' experiences of the divine to define your experience. In fact, Jeff and my Living the Questions program found one of its theme sentiments in a quote from my professor, Harold Beck. Steeped in the wisdom tradition of Hebrew scripture, Harold used to say, "The beginning of true wisdom is asking the questions for which there are no answers." And some of you may remember my Australian friend and colleague Val Webb speaking at the Fountains a number of years ago. In her book, In Defense of Doubt, she says to bring on your misgivings and skepticism. Embrace your uncertainties and questions. Revel in your unresolved dilemmas. They're all a vital part of the authentic spiritual journey denied to those who remain mired in the doctrines and dogmas of the past. Doubt, in fact, is a gift that is a prerequisite for any genuine evolution of the human spirit. Absolute certainty keeps us separated from God and our neighbors by claiming that what we know is the whole truth. There ain't no room for others' experience or input. When we're not open to ambiguity or different ways of looking at things, we risk becoming stagnant, stuck in a cul-de-sac rather than being out on the adventure. In verse 12 of our passage today, Jesus quotes the great theologian Billie Holiday, who sang,
"Them that's got shall have, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own."
Got his own what? The ability to tease out life's mysteries for oneself. If all you've got is what others have told you, and you're afraid to be open to what could be a personally demanding and transforming experience of the divine, then you're taking the easy way out. Every temptation we conquer gives us insight into wrestling with the next one. Every good but difficult thing we do strengthens us to be better able for the next. Every hard question we ask without receiving a satisfactory answer makes us more adept at honing our questions. Every ambiguity we wrestle with strengthens us for dealing with life's complexities. And yet, we long for and often settle for the simple answers, which is awkward. Seeking certainty puts us in the position of often having to defend God. Every time there's a plane crash or a killer hurricane or a school shooting, there's the inevitable witness or survivor who says, "Well, God must have had a reason for having taken little Billy away from us." Or the impossible task of defending a so-called all-loving, all-powerful God who stands by and does nothing, allowing the Holocaust to be perpetrated on God's own chosen people. Life is a process of understanding and frustration, of a little black and white and a whole lot of gray. Granted, there are some elements of life that do have clear cause and effect certainty to them. If you live in Arizona in the summertime and your car has black vinyl seats, do not wear shorts, or you'll be in for an unpleasant experience. But in matters of the heart and of the spirit, more often than not, the cause and effect formula just doesn't work. So beware of the person who says, "I've got God all figured out." Not even Jesus was that bold. Instead, he opted for stories that demanded thought, raised questions, and often went counter to conventional wisdom. In fact, I think it takes more faith to live in ambiguity than to say you believe in a dogmatic set of beliefs. We can't sit back fat and happy, confident that we have God in a box and all figured out. Bishop Jack Spong says, "I think certainty is a vice in religion, one of the things we ought to rid ourselves of." It takes work as we go down the road, sharing our experiences, our questions, our uncertainties with one another and with the divine. Grace comes in the midst of the search as we journey down the road together, which brings us to the fourth of 8 points of progressive Christianity. There's more grace in the search for meaning than in absolute certainty, in the questions than in the answers. Some of you know my fondness for the great American preacher, Harry Emerson Fosdick. 100 years ago, he was the spokesperson for progressive Christianity, what was then called modernism. When a young man asked to have a conversation with Fosdick, they did what he often did, which was to offer to go for a walk in Central Park. The young man said to Fosdick, "I'm jealous of your faith. I'm afraid to ask questions because I was raised in a faith that provided all the answers. To ask questions was to show unfaithfulness." Pausing at a reflecting pool in the park, Fosdick said, "Son, your faith is like this pool, calm, bordered, shallow. You always know what it's going to look like and what the boundaries are. But it's not a living faith. It's not going anywhere. Vital faith is like a stream bubbling up from a well deep within the earth. As it makes its way, it changes course. It twists and turns, is sometimes shallow and slow, and in some places fast and turbulent, responding to the reality of geography. Along the way, it's joined by the waters of other streams, and together, they make their way back to their source. Dynamic, flowing, moving. That's what a life of faith is all about." Friends, don't let answers be a substitute for a vital relationship with the mystery of the more, the divine, or whatever you call that unnameable, ungraspable, but ever-present spirit of life. Embrace the questions, wrestle with them, with others, and know that there's always more grace in the search than in certainty, in the questions than in the answers. And may the Spirit be with us on our journey. Be well.
Don't forget, if you like what you heard today, buy me a coffee. Thanks, Brianna. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.